From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, the latest on the Lockerbie trial. Pan Am Flight 103 exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland, December 21, 1988, killing 270 people. We'll have a conversation with the father of one of the victims and a former State Department official who questions the guilt of the Libyans on trial. Also, corporate accounting versus corporate accountability. And a Serb historian responds to a suppressed Pentagon report. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Microsoft gets its chance today to rebut the Justice Department proposal to split the company in two. That plan was submitted to a federal judge last month after he found Microsoft to be a monopoly that violates antitrust laws. Sources tell the Associated Press Microsoft may ask the judge to simply scrap most of the government plan, claiming it's based on evidence not presented during trial. Authorities have frozen $600 million worth of bank accounts belonging to the late Nigerian dictator General Sani Abacha and his family. The Luxembourg prosecutor's office opened an investigation at the request of the Nigerian government and has sent preliminary results back to Nigerian authorities for assessment. The move came after Swiss legal authorities brought charges in a case that has seen Swiss banks freeze $645 million in accounts belonging to Abacha and his associates in April. The Nigerian government believes that Abacha also has accounts in France and Germany. Abacha ruled Nigeria as a police state for 5 years, ending in June 1998, when he died of an apparent heart attack. His rule was notorious for its brutality and corruption. He was supported by the United States government. Communications regulators soon are expected to decide on AT&T's massive cable purchase of Media One, a deal that makes the phone giant also the nation's top cable TV company. Recommendations are now before the five commissioners at the Federal Communications Commission on how the merger could be completed while still complying with federal rules that limit how many cable households one entity may reach. The merger also must be cleared by the Justice Department. Los Angeles City officials say they want to meet with government officials to discuss how to overhaul the Los Angeles Police Department, a move both sides hope will prevent a federal lawsuit. The Justice Department threatened to file a police misconduct lawsuit Monday unless the city agrees to fix the LAPD, an organization it says is plagued by rogue officers and poor supervision. Several Los Angeles City Council members and a police commission spokesperson said yesterday they intend to cooperate in resolving the matter out of court. The federal action is the latest twist in the ongoing scandal in which anti-gang officers allegedly planted evidence, shot unarmed suspects, falsified reports, and gave false testimony to convict innocent people of crimes. The allegations have prompted criminal charges against three officers and led to about 30 being relieved of duty. So far, 73 felony convictions have been overturned since the scandal came to light last summer. This news from Columbus. Graduate students at Ohio State University have called for an economic boycott of the school to show support for a strike by union workers that has disrupted life on campus. About 1,900 custodians, food service workers, bus drivers, and other employees represented by the Communications Workers of America Local 4501 went on strike last week, mainly for higher wages. The strike has left trash piled up, buildings unclean, cafeterias closed, and some classes disrupted on the 48,000-student campus. Some professors have held classes outdoors rather than cross picket lines. Others canceled classes because of the strike. Poet Maya Angelou and NAACP President Kwesi Mfume both canceled appearances. Federal prosecutors reportedly will seek the death penalty against at least one of the suspects in the embassy bombings in Africa. The New York Times says Attorney General Janet Reno has okayed the effort. Lawyers in the case tell the paper the decision would result in the first U.S. death penalty case involving an act of international terrorism. The defendant is Mohammed Rashid Daoud al-Ohali, and he's accused of riding in the truck carrying the bomb that exploded at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, in August 1998. The bombing and simultaneous attack on the U.S. Embassy in Tanzania killed 224 people, including 12 Americans. And that's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And of course, tomorrow, the Federal Appeals Court in Atlanta will be hearing the case of Elian Gonzalez and deciding whether a six-year-old boy can apply for political asylum without the consent of his father. So we're finally going to get some sort of possible resolution of the Elian Gonzalez case tomorrow. We'll see.
And it looks like in Vieques that the Navy says it has resumed bombing using what they call dummy bombs. And it looks like the last of the protesters, more than 200 of them, some who took refuge in or who were hiding in the bush for a number of days, have been taken away.
Well, no, I don't think my understanding is from the information I've gotten is that there's the protest leaders are claiming that there's still about a half dozen people that are hiding out in the bush in Vieques. And I find it amazing that the Navy has begun using dummy bombs on Vieques without really figuring out whether it's true that there are some people still there. I know that one of the sons of Carlos Senong, the fisherman, told a colleague of mine just before the arrest that he had enough supplies and hiding places on Vieques to be able to survive for months. One of those sons, two of Senong's sons, Senong claims, are still on Vieques, so that the protests continue. And there was Ruben Berrios, the Independence Party leader, was threatening to return to Vieques yesterday to find a way to get back on the naval range. So this battle is far from over.
And, of course, the protesters in Vieques, the Puerto Rican island, which has been used as a bombing range by the U.S. Navy, they also lease it out to NATO allies to practice their bombing. It's protesters who've been camped out for about a year that stopped the bombing that were in the last days taken away by an FBI-led operation. And then the Navy says it will resume that bombing. Well, we're going to turn now to another issue, in fact, another bombing. At Camp Zeist in the Netherlands today, prosecutors in the trial of the two Libyans charged with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie called a number of civilians and police constables to testify on the recovery of items from the December 21, 1988 bombing. The prosecutors say this will lay the groundwork for the case against the two defendants. The two Libyans are charged with the murders of 270 people, including 189 Americans. We're joined right now by two people, Jack Schultz, one of the directors of victims of Pan Am Flight 103. His 20-year-old son, Thomas, was killed in the bombing. He was a university student on his way home for Christmas in 1988. And Michael Scharf is with us. He served as counsel for the Counterterrorism Bureau at the U.S. State Department 1989 to 1991 during the early stages of the investigation of the bombing. Jack Schultz, let's begin with you. Your son died 12 years ago. What is your position today on this trial?
Well, we're very hopeful that the trial will bring out all of the evidence for the world and the victims to see, in that we've been told by the prosecutors in Scotland that not all of it has seen the light of day. While the press has done a lot of investigative work and there's been a lot of conjecture, we're anxious to have the truth be known, and hopefully justice will be served as a result of the truth being known.
Well, Michael Scharf, you served on the Council for Counterterrorism Bureau at the U.S. State Department from 1989 to 1991. How do you view this trial, and do you think that it's going after the right culprits in this case?
Well, first of all, let me say that I don't believe there was any secret deal, which you hear a lot about in the press these days, to keep Gaddafi out of the case. But the way the prosecution is going, they're not going to be allowed to use a lot of the CIA intercepts, the confidential informant information that might be their best and most useful evidence to prove their case. And that's going to make the case hard, I think, for the prosecution to win, and also hard for the truth, the full truth, to be known, which is what Jack and the other families are looking for. But in addition, there's another problem, and that is during the 2 years that I was in the office of the legal advisor at the State Department, serving as counsel to the Counterterrorism Bureau, most of the evidence and most of the interest of the investigators was focused on the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, a PLO terrorist organization operating out of Syria, supposedly operating on the behest of Iran. And the reason there was so much focus there is, first of all, if you remember, the Vincennes, a U.S. Battleship, blew up an Iranian Airbus just 6 months before Pan Am 103 was blown up, and all of the officials in Iran vowed to get revenge, and they specifically said, we're going to find a way to blow up an American airliner to get revenge. And then 2 months before Pan Am 103 was blown up, the Mossad gave information to the German police, and they uncovered, in something called Operation Autumn Leaves, a cell of the PFLP General Command, this terrorist organization, operating in Frankfurt. And when they raided several of their apartments, they found five bombs in Toshiba radios. In fact, it was the very make, the Bombeat radio, it's one of these boom boxes, that was found in the wreckage of Pan Am 103. Now, the investigators are now saying, oh, the Pan Am boom box had two stereo speakers, and the five bombs found in Frankfurt only had one speaker, but that seems to be a very, you know, very fine hair. And so what it means is that there was another terrorist group that had motive and opportunity and was in the midst of planning to blow up Pan Am 103. In fact, one of the members of that group, a fellow by the name of Abu Talb, has also been identified as being in Malta, and in fact at the very place where the clothes that were found in the bomb suitcase was. And so the defense is going to try to say that it wasn't the Libyans, it was this PLO group, and they're going to use the defense of incrimination. It's going to be hard for the prosecution to win this case.
I wanted to ask you, Jack Schultz, about this letter that was sent from the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Can you explain what it is and why it has caused such a stir among the families of the victims of the bombing?
Yes, I can. But first I'd like to ask Michael why he believes that the evidence that the CIA, et cetera, has will not be allowed into the prosecution.
Ah, That's because in the United States, we have a special procedure called the Confidential Information Protection Act, CIPA, that allows, under some circumstances, the government to do an in-camera presentation just to a judge. And the judges from Scotland who are presiding over this case have rejected the plea of the prosecution to have a similar process. They say that all the evidence that we use must be on the public record. It must be available to the defense. And what they're worried about is allegations after the fact that it was an unfair trial. But what it means is that the U.S. government is going to be in the uncomfortable position of saying that we might have to put individuals' lives at danger if we want to win this case, because their identities as secret informants living in Libya, or the United States government will have to say, we're going to have to expose the full techniques available to us in terms of receiving and intercepting communications, which in the past the U.S. government has been loath to do.
And Michael, just following up on that, the Scottish judges, are they under what nation's laws are is this trial being conducted?
Okay, they're going to be using Scottish law, and it's very different from U.S. law in a variety of ways that are going to have a major impact on this case. First of all, they have something called the two-source rule, which means you cannot prove guilt unless there's cooperation from more than one credible testimony or evidence. That means if they have, as has been alleged, a Libyan defector who's going to say, I saw one of the defendants put the bomb on the plane, that's not enough. They're going to have a second source or there can be no conviction. Secondly, they have three different verdicts. In the United States, we only have guilty and not guilty. They have proven not guilty and then a weird compromise verdict called not proven. And what that means is often the judges will think there was evidence of guilt, but not enough evidence that it rises to the level of beyond reasonable doubt. And that could be the outcome in this case. Now, there are some things that are pro-prosecution. For instance, this is going to be before a three-judge panel, and rather than having a unanimous verdict requirement, as we have in the United States, they can make their decision by a 2-to-1 vote. All it takes is two of these three judges to decide that they're guilty. But if one decides they're guilty, one decides they're not guilty, and one thinks it's not proven, they're going to be acquitted. Also, there's no exclusionary rule in Scotland, and so no matter how the evidence was acquired, and there is going to be evidence here that was acquired in all sorts of strange ways, it is not excluded.
Well, Jack Schultz, how do you feel in terms of how the U.S. government has pursued this case, and even given what are obviously clear limitations in terms of protecting intelligence information of our own government, does that sit well with you that the government would withhold certain evidence to protect some intelligence sources?
Well, that doesn't sit well. It's the first time I've heard that, given that there were 270 people killed in this, murdered in this thing, that we're going to protect some witnesses. We have lots of ways of protecting witnesses. I think that would be more important than foregoing the winning of this case. There are a lot of things that are disconcerting. Obviously, you wanted to discuss the letter from Kofi Annan. I'm from the position that it is a UN document, and therefore it is for the UN to release it, not the U.S., even though the U.S. was party to it. But the problem for the families is when there's a letter and an agreement that's kept secret, all sorts of things come to mind as to what the agreement was to get these guys into trial. Speaking with the prosecutors in Scotland, who've been over here to visit with us just a couple of months ago, they assure us that their hands are not tied, they're not political appointees, and that they will go wherever the evidence takes them. And they have seen the letter, and they don't believe that it inhibits their ability to pursue the.
And you think the letter says what?
We have no idea what the letter says.
I think I have a pretty good idea what the letter says. You know, ultimately, the deal is that the two Libyans would be surrendered if, first, there was a lifting of the sanctions, second, if they could have a nonstop flight to the Netherlands right to Camp Zeiss so that the U.S. couldn't apprehend them and snatch them, third, that if they're convicted, that they have U.N. monitors at the prison in Scotland. It's called Berlini Prison. And fourth, that there would be a Libya consulate in Edinburgh near that prison so that their interests would be represented. That has all been publicly acknowledged, and I believe that's really all that's in the letter. The fact that the actual text of the letter has not been submitted is not out of the ordinary, although I would say in this circumstance that the UN is making a grave PR mistake by not submitting the text of the letter, because I don't think there is anything secret or mysterious in that letter.
Well, if that's what's in the letter, I don't see it's a problem. The mystery is that many of the people, family members, believe that there was a deal made with Gaddafi, that if these two guys are proven guilty, that prosecution then won't go to the state of Libya and to himself. And that does bring the point to the surface, that if these two guys are proven guilty, obviously they just didn't do it on their own. What is the justice to be meted out against the state that sponsored their terrorism?
Yeah, well, already there was a pretrial hearing where the defense argued that the conspiracy charge should be set aside because nothing actually occurred in Scottish territory, which is normally a requirement of conspiracy. Had that been successful, you actually would have seen this be just a simple murder trial, and there would have been no mention of Gaddafi. But Andrew Hardy, who was the Lord Advocate General at that time, argued strenuously that the conspiracy charge should stay in. The judge who was presiding over that, who is Lord Sutherland, finally decided that the conspiracy charge should stay in. What that means is that they're going to prove not just that these two individuals planted the bomb, but that they acted as part of the intelligence unit of Libya, presumably following orders all the way up to Gaddafi. And so by the way that the prosecutor has acted already, I think it indicates that this letter could not be a shield to keep Gaddafi out of the case.
And Michael Scharf, you think that's going to be pretty hard to prove?
Well, yeah, it's the problem is...
we have 30 seconds.
Yes, for every important piece of evidence the prosecution has, this is a 12-year-old case, and there's a lot of other evidence on the other side. The identifications of the individuals have now been suspect. The circuit board, which is their best material evidence, is now said to have come from a different source. And so what we're going to see is over a year-long trial, 1,000 witnesses, lots and lots of evidence, but there are two stories that are going to emerge, one that points the finger at the Libyans and Gaddafi, the other that points the finger at the Palestinians. And it'll depend very much on Scottish procedures what verdict ultimately comes out of this trial.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Of course, there's other stories going around also that the USDA has used these flights for a long time for drug runs and for sting operations in the United States. And we'll talk more about that, considering we've got a year that this trial is expected to go on. Michael Scharf, counsel for the Counterterrorism Bureau at the State Department, formerly, that was in 89 to 91, now a professor at New England School of Law, currently working on a book on the case. And Jack Schultz, one of the directors of victims of Pan Am Flight 103. His son Thomas was killed in the Pan Am bombing. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at corporate accountability. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Microsoft gets its chance today to rebut the Justice Department proposal to split the company in two. That plan was submitted to a federal judge last month after he found Microsoft to be a monopoly that violates antitrust laws. Sources tell the Associated Press Microsoft may ask the judge to simply scrap most of the government plan, claiming it's based on evidence not presented during the trial. So Microsoft wants to set its own rules for what will happen to it. And today, you will see, if you're watching television or listening to the corporate media, you'll see industry analysts up and down the dial, or hear them, talking about what should happen to Microsoft. But there are other voices you should be hearing. You should be hearing the voices that broke through the corporate media blockade for just a few minutes. That was in the battle in Seattle. You occasionally saw people speaking from the streets in Seattle, and also the protests against the World Bank and the IMF in Washington, D.C. But it's these very people who we should hear on a daily basis. When you see the Dow Jones Industrial has gone up or down, you only get industry analysts responding to it. What about those who are leading a movement against corporate globalization? Today, we bring you one of those people. He's Kevin Danaher. His books are include his latest, which is Globalize This, and it's put out by an independent small press in Maine, Common Courage Press. He spoke recently about corporate accountability. It's called Corporate Accounting or Corporate Accountability. This is Kevin Danaher, one of the founders of Global Exchange in San Francisco.
The title of the talk is Corporate Accounting versus Corporate Accountability. Corporate accounting versus corporate accountability. And the question for us is, which are we going to have? That's the struggle, I think, that's going to dominate politics on the face of the earth for the next few decades. Under corporate accounting, people and nature are reduced to numbers. And the system subordinates the public interest to private interests. The public interest to have social needs like education, healthcare, housing, mass transit be met, versus the private interests of private corporations to maximize their profits in whatever way they can get away with. There's an interesting title by a man named Ralph Estes. It's called The Tyranny of the Bottom Line, Why Corporations Make Good People Do Bad Things. Very interesting book. And what he shows is built into the system, genetic to the system, by putting profit maximization of private corporations as the central value, people's needs go unmet and nature gets destroyed almost automatically. So what happens is you get two bad effects of this system, of this sort of genetic tendency to put private profits ahead of public good. It produces more and more inequality all the time, and it tends to destroy nature, all aspects of nature. First, the inequality. The richest 20% of the world's people consume 86% of the world's resources. I've drawn a diagram on the board here. You can see if you divide the world's population into fifths, the richest fifth of the world's population accounts for 86% of all consumption spending. That means that the poorest 80% of the world's people account for only 14% of world consumption spending. It kind of gives a different twist to the word overpopulation. If you ever want to do a little experiment with people to prove to them that we've had a racist ideology pumped into our heads about what's going on in the world, say this. Say, okay, close your eyes and I'm going to say a word. And when I say the word, I want you to visualize a group of people in your mind's eye. And they close their eyes and you say, overpopulation. And if they're honest, they will admit that they saw dark-skinned people. They did not visualize white suburban mall shoppers, right? Because we've had it pumped into our heads that the people who are the problem in terms of the numbers is people in Africa, Asia, Latin America. Well, when you correct for consumption, because it's not about numbers of people. It's about how heavily do those people walk on the face of the earth, how much of the endowment, the natural endowment of the earth, are they sucking up. Right, and wasting. Just drive around on any street in the United States and you'll see a grand display of it. This richest 20% of the world's population also accounts for about 75% of the world's environmental destruction. Some people call it pollution. I like to call it environmental destruction because I think that's what it is. The richest 20% of the world's people account for 75% of the world's environmental destruction. Now, there's more and more global inequality all the time, and the system keeps producing more and more inequality and greater distance between the rich, the powerful, those who rule, and those who are ruled over. But the inequality in the United States is getting greater, too. If you look at the data between 1980 and 1995, corporate revenues jumped 129% in the United States. Corporate profits rose 127%. Executive pay increased 182%. If you go back to 1980, the average chief executive officer of a major U.S. corporation got paid about 41 times what the average worker got paid. That's in 1980. It's a 41-to-1 ratio between CEO and average worker. You come up to 1997, that ratio had jumped to 326-to-1. I have pie charts in my book, Corporations Are Going to Get Your Mama, that shows if you take bond ownership, stock ownership, real estate ownership, the richest 10% of the population controlled about 88% of the stock, bonds, and real estate. The richest 1% of American families own more wealth, and wealth is a better indicator of inequality than income, because, you know, Tom Hanks made $40 million last year, but Tom Hanks isn't part of the power elite, right? He made a lot of income, but you got to look at wealth, the ownership of the factories and industry. Well, the richest 1% of American families own more wealth than the poorest 90%, right? Incredible inequality, and it's getting worse all the time. Now, Justice Brandeis, former Supreme Court justice, had a great comment on this. He says, quote, "We can either have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few. But we can't have both." If you go back 200 years to the beginning of the Republic, right after this country was founded, the growing power of private corporations was scary enough to cause Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence and some great ideas, say, and I quote, "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of the country. The growing power of the corporations have allowed them to increasingly define our existence." Go back, read Charles Durber's book, Corporation Nation, where he goes over the history of the corporation in the United States. Great book, Corporation Nation by Charles Durber, professor in Boston. He shows how when corporations were first allowed to exist in this country, we defined them. We put very strict limits on how long they would exist, what work they would be allowed to do, how much capital they could accumulate. And throughout the 1800s, when corporations violated those charters, they had their charters removed, right? Just like you would remove a tumor from the body politic. It was cut out, right? And they were not allowed to exist anymore as corporations. Look at different areas of our society. Transportation. Do we get mass transit systems that are run by solar power and geothermal and, you know, that have buses and trolleys everywhere so that we don't have to rely on individual vehicles? No. We have highways and cars because that's more profitable for industry. And industry is allowed to get its way with our government in Washington and get the kind of policy they want. Healthcare. What have we seen over the past couple decades? The privatization of healthcare. Talk to people about HMOs. See if you can find a positive experience. People always, oh, the HMOs. Ugh. I got Kaiser out in California. My organization has, we subscribe to Kaiser, which is one of the better ones because it's a nonprofit. And even there, people will complain about it. Why? Because money rules. It's money values, not human values, right? Social values that determine what the policies will be. Now they want to privatize education. Yeah, let's have happen to education what we had happen to healthcare. What's the HMO equivalent of a school system? I mean, this is mind-boggling what a disaster it's going to be. Then we'll for sure have a two-tier society where there'll be the drones, the working class majority, whose kids will go to the inferior schools, and the elites, the children of the elites, will go to the elite schools, and that way we'll keep replicating an uneven class structure and an unequal distribution of power in the country. Look at energy, right? Do we have solar and geothermal and wind and all these kinds of renewable energy sources? Or are we locked into nuclear and burning dead dinosaurs, fossil fuels, coal, petroleum, et cetera? Well, why did that happen? Why didn't we? Just think, if we had invested in this country, the money we invested in nuclear, if that had, because it was all government subsidy. You know, let's talk about free market. There's no free market. It's a joke. The government subsidized that. That is, we, the people, with our tax money, subsidized the development of the nuclear power industry. Well, it's hard to make bombs out of solar. That might have been one of the main reasons, and they wanted a way to destroy hundreds of thousands of people in one fell swoop. But imagine if the money that had been put into nuclear power development had been put into solar. All of our homes, all of our cars, everything would be running off solar. That technology, you know, the cost per kilowatt hour, would be able to compete with any other energy source. But the government didn't do that, because who were the people in government under the influence of? They were under the influence of the oil companies, right? So we get a crazy policy, a policy that's not in the interest of nature and not in the interest of the majority. So another major aspect of this, when corporations gain in power politically, they are able to whittle down the amount of taxes they pay. I have data in the introduction to my book showing that if you go back to the 1950s, for every dollar that you and I, average citizen, paid in taxes, corporations paid about 76 cents in taxes. You come up to the 1990s, for every dollar you and I paid in taxes, corporations paid about 21 cents in taxes. They've gradually whittled down the amount that they carry of the federal income tax burden. In 1950, the corporations were paying 26.4% of federal income tax. By 1995, corporations were carrying just 11.6% of the total federal income tax load. Well, what does that do? It creates a fiscal crisis of the state, the bankrupting of government. Notice in the debates about the fiscal crisis of government and the budget deficit, it's all about the expenditure side. Oh, we're spending too much on welfare. We're spending too much on the military. We're spending too much on Social Security. Wait a minute. A fiscal crisis comprises two halves, the revenue side and the expenditure side. Fiscal crisis, by definition, is the tendency of revenues to not keep up with expenditures, or for expenditures to outrace revenues. Well, let's look at the revenue side. The revenue side that shows that the corporations, through their increasing political power, all their hundreds of lobbyists in Washington that are paid high salaries, they have been able to whittle down their share of the tax load. Now, they couldn't dump it all on us, so they might get a rebellion on their hands. A lot of it was dumped onto the working class. But the rest, where did they get it from? Debt. Government goes into debt. The federal government and a lot of other governments issue debt. They issue bonds. A bond is a promissory note that says, you give me $1,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 today, and over the life of this bond, I will pay you X percent per year, 5%, 6%, 7%, until it's paid off in the year 2010, 2015, what have you. So think what they're doing. And this is not only at the federal government level, right? It's also government agencies, state, county, city. There's water districts. There's all sorts of school improvement bonds. What they're doing is reaching into the future and borrowing from future generations in order to spend money in the present. So when people are walking around today saying, oh, gee, you know, the economy, the U.S. economy is doing great. If you took out of the U.S. economy, just imagine if you sucked out of the U.S. economy the $5.5 trillion that the federal government owes, the over $4 trillion that is owed by government agencies like Federal Home Loan Board and all the, you know, loans to farmers and all that, and then threw in all the debt of counties and states and cities, then $1 trillion of consumer debt, us with our plastic credit cards, right? If you took all of that debt, the borrowing from future generations, out of the current economy, we'd be in a depression worse than the 1930s. Right? That's what we're living on. That's what allows us to be going around with our cell phones and driving our new sport utility vehicles and all that kind of stuff. It's debt. It's bringing demand from the future to the present and spending it and keeping the economy pumped up. So one other thing I have to touch on before we leave this, before I go over to the alternative of corporate accountability, is the question of the mass media. It always comes up, you know, the mass media. Well, you know, if we don't do something about the mass media, you know, we got all this brainwashing going on, which it should be called brain dirtying, I guess, but it's called brainwashing. Now think, most people, 99-point-some percent of people in this country and probably around the world, don't understand what the mass media is. They have it backwards, right? In Econ 101, the neoclassical economists say, consumer sovereignty. So you vote with your dollars. So if you don't like the Denver Post, don't buy it. And they'll be forced to change.
Kevin Danaher, he is editor of the book Globalize This, which has just been published by Common Courage Press. He is one of the co-founders of the human rights group Global Exchange. This speech that he recently gave was recorded by Alternative Radio. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A suppressed U.S. Air Force report reveals that the actual number of targets destroyed by the NATO air campaign in Kosovo last year was a tiny fraction of what military brass had boasted. The suppressed report, which was obtained by Newsweek magazine, shows that while the NATO campaign claimed 120 tanks were destroyed, in fact, only 14 tanks were destroyed. They said that 220 armored personnel carriers were bombed. Only 18 were bombed. They said 450 artillery pieces were hit. Only 20 were actually hit. Indeed, instead of the 744, quote, confirmed strikes by NATO pilots in the 78-day campaign, Air Force investigators found evidence of not 744, but just 58 strikes. At the time of the NATO action, Defense Secretary William Cohen declared, "We severely crippled the Serbian military forces in Kosovo by destroying more than half of the artillery and one-third of the armored vehicles." Well, this report begs the question, if NATO wasn't hitting military targets, what were they really bombing? We're joined today by Dušan Bataković. He's a professor of history at the University of Belgrade. He's written several books on Kosovo and was a member of the Serbian Orthodox Church delegation at Rambouillet. That's what produced the Rambouillet Accord, delivered to Milosevic by Richard Holbrooke. Because Milosevic rejected it, the NATO forces bombed. That in itself is extremely controversial. But Professor Dušan Bataković, let's begin with this suppressed U.S. Air Force report. And first, welcome to Democracy Now!
My first impression is that we're talking about something which is already well known here and elsewhere. The problem with the NATO bombing was that they faced a very skillful Yugoslav military on the ground, who made thousands, if not hundreds, decoys who were imitating real military targets. While NATO airplanes were flying very high, they couldn't identify what was really the target, really the tank or something else, and what were those decoys. On the other hand, who was choosing those targets? It was usually done by Albanians from so-called Kosovo Liberation Army on the ground, who were actually using NATO as their own air power, and they suggested targets they wanted to be bombed. So if you have those two moments in mind, you can see that it was not easy to bomb the real targets. However, well, what I have seen in Kosovo on the ground, I saw only a few tanks destroyed, a few army vehicles. What is the official percentage here coming from the Yugoslav sources is that 0.6 of all military equipment was destroyed. Therefore, NATO was not bombing in the Kosovo the real targets. They usually fail to get the appropriate targets. And on the other hand, because of the failure in Kosovo, they were obliged to bomb civilian targets in order to get some success and to produce military victory. But it happened only when NATO was targeting military targets. Not military, but civilian targets, like electricity stations, power stations, and things like that.
You know, it's interesting, the conclusion of the Newsweek report, which was done by the highest level reporters at Newsweek, was basically that civilian bombing does work, that you terrorize a population, and that is what's going to win the war, more than surgical strikes against military. What's your response to that, considering you're the civilians we're talking about?
Well, as a civilian, I had a severe heart attack just a few days before the bombing started. And I spent the first month of bombing when there was only military targets on the spot in the hospital, and afterwards I went out. And what I have seen, that there was a very high moral background all over. Therefore, it was absolutely impossible to win the war the way the NATO won this one, only by targeting military targets. Only when we as civilians were deprived from water supply and electricity for weeks, then the general moral became to get less strong, and many people after these things started to think that we should sign some kind of treaty, because when there is no water and no electricity, it is the end of the civilization.
Professor Batakovic, Milosevic, the Yugoslav president, was indicted by The Hague as a war criminal. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that Milosevic is guilty, but for things he has done to his own people. I don't think that this indictment is facilitating the overall settlement. On the other hand, he is a hero for those who think that NATO bombing was illegal and immoral. So, in all respects, it is a wrong decision all the way up. So he is guilty, but he should be judged here by our courts, not by Hague. And secondly, this indictment in a political way is just not facilitating how we can overthrow his regime here and established democracy. It's getting more difficult now.
You're based in Belgrade, at the University of Belgrade, but you've spent a lot of time in Kosovo. The way the Western press portrays the Serbs who live in Kosovo that haven't been driven out yet is very pro-Milosevic. What's your experience of the Serbs in Kosovo?
Well, the Serbs in Kosovo, like Albanians over there, they have a very low political culture. And they were, during the last decade, very easily manipulated for political means. But I think that Kosovo Serbs now are very pro-Serb. They are not very pro-Milosevic. There are some of them, of course, who are blaming everybody else except Milosevic for what happened to them. But in general, they just want a decent life, which they don't have. And the situation was much better for them under Milosevic than it is now under NATO. We should mention here that there is more than 100 Serbian Orthodox churches burned to the ground by Albanian extremists, and then there is no basic security in the Kosovo at all, and the people are living like in a prison. So if you're going from one village to another, you have to be accompanied and protected by 6 American, British, or French tanks. So it doesn't look like life at all. So Serbs nowadays in Kosovo, they live in small enclaves, fearing their life and hearing terrible stories about what has happened to other Serbs who are not living in the big enclaves and who are not sufficiently protected. Every day we have a very disturbing news coming from Kosovo about killings, rapes. We have about 1,200 Serbs who are missing persons. And Albanian mafia is practically the only master on the ground. NATO is only a present force, and NATO forces are telling us, and they're telling to Kosovo Serbs, we are not policemen, we are soldiers, but actually the only organization which is having effective power on the ground is Albanian mafia, which is very powerful, and Serbs and Albanians alike are very afraid of them.
What do you think was the point of the bombing? I mean, now you have this reverse situation in Kosovo where the Serbs are being terrorized in Kosovo. What was the point?
Well, I think it was a wrong perception that within a week the bombing will be over and there will be a huge success for NATO in a year which is celebrating the 50th anniversary of NATO. Milosevic, on the other side, needed this bombing because he couldn't give up Kosovo without fighting. He couldn't survive in Serbia. Nobody can survive in Serbia if he give up Kosovo to somebody else. And on the other, and the third element, which was also important, is the Kosovo Albanians who were using Milosevic as an alibi for everything bad what is happening in this region for the last 10 years. And they saw that only if there is a war like in Croatia or Bosnia, they can obtain something. So they opted for war. I think those three elements contributed that NATO became eager to use force, and unfortunately everything what was promised in the beginning, that they will build up a multi-ethnic, multicultural and tolerant Kosovo, is a complete failure today.
We're talking to Dušan Bataković, who is a professor of history at the University of Belgrade and was also an advisor to the Serbian Orthodox Church and a member of the Serbian Orthodox Church delegation at Rambouillet. Where is this all leading right now?
Well, this is leading us to something which I would call no solution, no exit policy. I think that at this point, we have the whole region fully destabilized. Milosevic is still in power in Serbia. Albania is not stabilized. Macedonia is practically on the verge of destruction. And I think the mono-ethnic principle has prevailed instead of multi-ethnic concept, which was praised by the Western and the NATO powers. I think that NATO, KFOR, United Nations, and all those in charge should work hard to build up some kind of confidence on the ground by strictly applying international law. I think that Kosovo Albanians were regarded as the natural allies of the NATO, and they have still not faced any kind of punishment for many crimes that have been committed during the last year under KFOR and under NATO. And I think that it is a very wrong policy and it is giving a wrong message to the whole region. Therefore, I think that this policy should be completely changed and that some kind of hardline administration should be implemented on the ground, which will enable all refugees, Serbs, Albanians, or Romas alike, to come to their home and to build a decent life, which will take at least another 15 years.
One last question, and that is an issue that is not getting a lot of attention here, is the invasions into Serbia from eastern Kosovo, which is the U.S. sector, controlled by the U.S., invasions of KLA or a formation of it. Can you talk about that?
Yes, unfortunately, the problem with Kosovo is not located only in Kosovo itself. There is a tiny Albanian minority within other municipalities in inner Serbia, and three of them are bordering eastern Kosovo. Therefore, the KLA formations and many other Albanian terrorist groups are trying to provoke a series of crises over there in order to change interest from what is happening actually in Kosovo, and which is also a terror, but against Serbs. So they are trying to provoke Milosevic in the north, in the southern Serbia, just in order to legitimize what has already been done at Kosovo itself, an ethnic cleansing against the Serbs.
Dusan Butaković is a professor of history at the University of Belgrade and author of several books on Kosovo. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Jeremy Scahill, and Maria Carrion. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Our engineer today is Matthew Finch. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Clinton and our Vajpayee. Absolutely identical. And you know, it doesn't matter anymore whether it's Congress or BJP or the United Front. Just as